This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on every purchase. Plus, earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
From NPR Music, this is Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras. This week, we're going to visit the U.S.-Mexico border. It stretches 1,954 miles from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico. The intersection of humanity along that imaginary line is very real. And beyond the headlines are stories of people who live along the border, who have arrived there from distant lands, and people who live a life with one foot on either side. We're going to hear three stories this week that will hopefully put the border in a different light. A story about a festival of music that you would not expect from the border. And we're going to hear from a musician from Colombia who has found a place for herself and her music on the southern side of the line. And a story about bullfighting, but not in the way you think. First up, that bullfighting story. We're going to meet Fred Rank. He is a 74-year-old former amateur bullfighter who runs a bull ranch called La Querencia, just north of McAllen, Texas, which is about 10 miles from the border. He runs a bullfighting school. It's one of the few bullfighting schools that teaches what one bullfighter calls 20 minutes of absolute truth to women as well as men. This interview is produced by Katie Hayes-Luke, a photojournalist who is working on a book about bullfighting. And it is important to note that on this side of the border, bullfighting is a bloodless sport. The bulls live.
My name is Fred Rank. I built the only bull ring in the whole 49 states of the United States. And I built it here in the year 2000, 15 years ago.
And where are we?
We're in La Gloria, Texas. North of the valley, McAllen, about 45 minutes.
And is there much bullfighting culture around here?
No, there never has been. You know, the only way we got the culture started was to put on the fights for the school kids. We started in Roma, and we brought 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th graders. Not kids with their pants hanging down around their rear ends, the high school bunch. And we've worked all the way into McAllen now. But it's teaching them their culture. You know, the Hispanic, being a Mexican is one thing, but they also have that Spanish blood in them. So they walk out of here real proud, these young kids. So that's what we do on the off season, before school lets out. And we feed them and bring them out here free. School buses coming, one right after another. You can put 1,400 kids in that bull ring out there. But it's always been fun to do that.
So tell me a little bit about how, where you're from and how you got interested in bullfighting and your history with that.
Well, I've lived in the valley, you know, most of my life, but was raised in the mountains of New Mexico on the Raton Pass, Colorado-New Mexico line, and went to the seminary when I was real young in Santa Fe and studied to be a priest. And I saw my first bullfight in 1952. When I was an exchange student at the University of Chihuahua, in the capital of Chihuahua, the state of Mexico, it was Pepe Luis Vasquez. And I never forgot it. And I came back and my vocation had somewhat dimmed, and so I left the seminary and joined the Marine Corps. And when I came back from the overseas, Korea and Japan, I went right away to Mexico to try to be a bullfighter.
And how old were you?
Oh, I was 19, 20. 20 years old, 21. That's exactly 21, because I did 4 years in the Marine Corps.
And can you tell me, I was thinking last night about like how somebody's passion may stay the same, but their vision for themselves may change. So when you were 21, what was your vision within bullfighting for yourself?
Well, I had a job. You know, I was selling water treatment equipment. And I'm still doing it. We're still building water treatment purification equipment. But, you know, to go to Mexico and try to, there was no gringos, no Americans fighting in those years. The one that was in Spain, John Fulton. And just to get somebody to help train you. You know, you're learning to do, it's like taking ballet. You get in there, you learn how to move the capes, and of course you have to overcome your fear too. You know, the first time you get in front of an animal. First time I did, it was here in Reynosa, and I came down to fight. I couldn't move. Couldn't move my hands, couldn't do anything. You know, the bull moved the cape for me. So then I started moving, and it was okay. But I fought, you know, I didn't fight a lot, not like my son has fought, but I think that opened the door for David, really. So the great thing about it was I was appearing in Juarez, and I met David's mother in the bull ring. I dedicated a bull to her. I called her the White Dove, because I didn't know that she was third runner-up Miss Texas back in those years, you know. She worked at the phone company. But I went to Las Cruces where she was working, and I took her out to lunch and took her out to dinner 3 weeks in a row, every night out to dinner, and married her. Then I had David. There was David. He saw me wounded in Juarez when he was 4.5 years old, but he still wanted to go on and try. He didn't play with cap guns in the backyard. He played with a stick and a napkin as a bullfighter. But he was crippled. He was born crippled, club feet. So we had his feet operated on at Hotel Du Hospital, and he was in a wheelchair, and would you believe that Pepe Luis Vasquez came to the third largest bull ring in the world, which was Juarez, the Monumental, and it was his last fight there. He saw David because he knew me, and he went over and dedicated the bull to David. Said, you can do anything, anything that you try to do in life, and you can do it. And David's not supposed to say anything. He said, even be a matador like you? He said, yes. And 10 years to the day, from that day, David became a full matador in that bull ring, and Pepe Luis was standing there right beside me. So it was quite a story to see him do that. And then of the five before him, he was the sixth since 1901. And the five before him had never confirmed in the world's largest ring. David went in there in 83, and being the only North American to ever get his PhD. See, your doctorate is when you become a matador, but you've got to confirm it. But David did it and accomplished it, and there's been no Americans since. Quite a feat.
So then did you, once you were not, I mean, your passion still was bullfighting.
Oh,
and then it became David's...
his career. After David had fought for about 15 years, I came out and bought this ranch and moved my company out here, Rink Water Systems International. And I was sitting at this very table one day, and my compadre was a Vietnam vet, and he'd always been out here to help me with electrical and all that, and I know that you met him over a few years ago, Joe Palmas. I said, we're going to build a bull ring, come on. We walked out in that field over there, and I put a stake in the ground, and I said, now walk over there 45 steps. And he walked over there, I said, put a stake there. Now go over 10 steps here, like that, to make a perfect circle. The next day we were putting posts in the ground. And we got that part of it built in about 2 months, out of steel and welding. And then I said, well, we got the ring, you know, now we got to have some seats, you know, for people to sit. My idea was to form a bullfight school. We had David to help. We had Raquel Martinez, who was the first lady matador in history, would come down and teach. We had Pepe Luis. We had Jim Verner. They were all willing to help. But, you know, so we built some seats, and we had no corrals. What are we going to do? We bring in fighting bulls. We got to have corrals. So that's what happened out there. There's 100,000 feet of 8-inch sea purling in that bull ring. And at that time, it was $1 a foot. Today, it's worth about $3. And then you got to talk about the labor. We had 3 welders going, and all of a sudden, we had a bull ring there, and we had seats, and we had corrals, and now we brought the animals in. Rafael Mendoza, that's where that started. And we brought the cows and started breeding the animals here. So we're the only breeder in 49 states, as well as the only bull ring. And it's still going on. It's like they say in the bullfight world, the gusano has you. The worm is in your stomach, constantly eating, eating away at you, you know, until you bigger, bigger, bigger. So look at us. Here we are and have a bullfight like we had yesterday. The thing completely almost sold out. You know, the first one was a sellout. And then have little Carla and all these other matadors coming. And you help them, that's helping them too. Because the publicity, for instance, Lupita Lopez fought here 5 years. She was in the New York Times sports section. Big, big photographs. Kirsten, I can't remember her last name, but she went even to Mexico City when she became a full matador. I mean, she started here. So a lot of people have started here. Look at little Carla. She performed so great yesterday, and you heard what her father said this morning. She's going to fight on horseback as well. But, you know, and I can't think of how many have come here to the bullfight school. Two have made it to be novilleros. There's no matadors yet, but who knows? Who knows? There may be one coming. But that's the way we did it. And today, looking at that bull ring out there, and the acoustics in that thing are beautiful. You know, I asked a guy, any questions? I didn't do it yesterday, but I normally do. I said, any questions? And some old guy on the other side says, well, how long you been raising these fighting bulls? He says, I've been raising bucking bulls for about 40 years. And I said, well, in 300 B.C., a bull came into an amphitheater in Crete, and four gladiators were waiting for him. An hour later, they were all laying on the ground, and the bull left. That's how long we've been working with fighting animals, fighting stock. It's that old. And boy, he said, took his hat off and bowed and sat back down, you know. But that's why that big photo is out there of that bull as Alexander the Great. And he said, you're getting their majestic snorting greets the eyelids of the dawn. Quote by Alexander the Great, 300 B.C. And Julius Caesar, they are the bulls, 100 A.D. So there's 2,000 years right there. The fighting bull has been a leader in 13 countries, the leading art, not a sport, art, because they call it the ballet of death there. Ours is called the ballet of life because the bull lives and he gets to go to the rodeo and chase the clowns the rest of his life, you know. So it's kind of unique. That's just Fred Rank's idea.
Since 2009, Katie Hayes-Luke has been traveling to southern Texas to document bloodless bullfighting at La Querencia. You can see her photos at the NPR photography website, The Picture Show. You are listening to Alt Latino from NPR Music, and that is the music of performer Natalia Serna, who calls herself La Muna. She's a Colombian-American musician who lives on the southern side of the border. The song is called Fuego and was inspired by 3 nights she spent riding La Bestia, a train running from southern Mexico that transports migrants to the U.S. border, where they await their fate. Alt Latino contributor Rihanna Cruz talked to Serna with the cooperation of Palabra, the digital outlet of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Cruz talked to La Muna over Zoom from a house in Hermosillo, Mexico, that she has converted into a refuge for immigrants seeking asylum in the United States. She started the interview by asking La Muna about the inspiration for moving to Mexico.
Because I grew up between Colombia and the U.S., I feel like I've always lived between a couple different worlds. And when I moved to Chicago to do college, I lived in Pilsen, which was like the most amazing neighborhood you can live in Chicago. It was just like bustling with Mexican Latino life, you know? And there was this amazing energy in the barrio, you know? And there's so many musicians. And I started to just fall in love, I think, with Mexico. And at the same time, with this whole post 9/11 world in the U.S., things just really got nasty towards Latinos. And I think that realizing that my neighbors were being detained, seeing these huge marches that happened around 2008, which I think culminated in L.A., seeing hundreds of thousands of Latinos, Mexicans, and people that were undocumented in general on the street really got my attention, be like, what's going on, you know? And so that took me, for the first time, brought me down to the border in 2000, the summer of 2009. Spent a little time on the Arizona border with a group called No More Deaths that does really great work right in the desert. They used to have a camp back that year in the middle of the desert, literally. And then I came down to Mexico and I did some, you know, some traveling with Central American migrants. And I did the train between Veracruz, which is kind of southern central Mexico, all the way to San Luis Potosí. And that really just, I think that there's moments in life where something happens to you and you're like, I'm never going to be the same person again, you know? And I think that was one of those moments where it's like, this, like, I'm just never going to be the same person again. Being on a train, being with these guys, like, experimenting the what they were feeling, doing this journey with them, sensing this amount of solidarity that migrants have for each other, it was just so moving. I was like, you know. And so I left a couple of years and came back in 2003, and I have not left Mexico since. I spent between 2003 and 2007 on the border in Nogales, Arizona, which is just about an hour south of Tucson. And I spent 3 years there working with folks that had been deported. A lot of people deported from Phoenix, from the Arizona region, a lot of dads. And that was, you know, I think for my music, at least, that was like a change. You know, once I came to Mexico, I started to write about what was going on around me, not so much within me. I think for most musicians, we're sentimental. And it's like, whoa, me and my world and this and that. But coming to the border, I was like, whoa, the world, oh my God. And I was just awash in this amount of emotion, being just like, I don't know, pummeled by the degree of pain and injustice that you see on the border every day, you know? And so spent a bunch of years on the border, and right now I'm here in Hermosillo. And my current work, it deals more with folks that are asking for refugee status, and primarily Central Americans that are traveling to the border and that are fleeing Central America because of just this increasing chaos that's making life impossible.
That's perfect. That sums it up the best. So in the article, you say a really interesting thing about your music not wanting to be commercial, which I think is a really interesting way to look at it. Who is specifically your audience, and what is your intent when you create?
You know, I'm really like, I'm pretty folk and pop, you know, because I didn't go to school. So I would say my music isn't, its format isn't anti-commercial. It's, you know, I think I write music that's based out of folk and pop primarily. But the themes are just not that commercial, you know, because most people really don't want to sit around and like think about how the border is falling apart and the pain that these people are bringing to this situation, you know. And so I don't know who my audience is. I don't really think of an audience, and I use whatever format I think will respect the lyrics of the songs, you know. So there are songs that I have written that the lyrics maybe are really painful, and for some reason I feel like a huapango or like a more Southern traditional folk style will work for it. And then there are other songs that are rap. You know, I'm not great at making rap, but for some reason I feel like the way that the words will be transmitted the best will get to the listener the best would use that format. So it really just depends. The words, I think, for me guide the format that I use. And I also really don't think of it much because most of these songs are coming from the experiences of those around me. I feel like if you start to think about it a lot, you're just getting in the way, you know? And so it's really just, it's more of a visceral experience. Whatever comes out, it just, that's what it is, you know? And you just let it go. And then, you know, I try and these songs that I write, you know, about the people around me, of course, at the end, you have to take them back to the person that from which the song was born, right? And for me, it's like, if the song works for them, then I'm happy with it, you know?
Do you find it uplifting, or is it more of a draining experience? Because I feel like when you're writing songs about this type of topic, it can be a little bit emotionally taxing.
I think that what's emotionally taxing is just not having an answer for people, you know. It's like being on the border and receiving a dad that's just been deported and being like, I just don't know how to get you back to your kids. You know, that is terrible, you know. Or seeing a refugee family here and fighting for a year with the government to get the refugee status and being denied and then being like, I just don't know what else to do. I think, you know, the reality of the world is taxing, but art always gives us a reason to believe that it's worth it. You know, there's something redemptive about art where we're like, it life is sometimes, but then you make it into a piece of art and it's like, yeah, but there's something beautiful about it, but there's something eternal about it, but there is something about it, you know? And so I think that if it weren't for the songs, really, I don't think I could keep doing it. It's just like the escape valve for me.
Yeah, totally. So I've assumed you've crossed paths with a lot of people, all with interesting stories and walks of life. Can you tell a story specifically that has given you hope, perhaps, in your line of work?
There's always, you know, certain people that you remember with, like, I don't know, in a special way. And I remember a lot a man by the name of Mr. Hernandez, who is from central Mexico. And he was like the first deported dad I was very close to, and he spent maybe like 4 or 5 months on the border. And Mr. Hernandez, you know, he had done like everything right that you're supposed to do as a Mexican dad, you know, left when he was 14. His rancho in Guanajuato was the first one from his rancho to go to the U.S., like made it in the dairy farm business, and got his truck, got his house, had his 4 kids. And he's just like, he has this beautiful voice of like the movie era of Mexico, where he's just like, he was just struck me as an amazing person. And, you know, one day he's driving to school to pick up his kids and he gets detained by an officer that says, get out of the car and where's your social security number? And he's like, I don't have one, right? So he gets deported. You know, these things happen overnight. And he spent the last 15 years of his life in the U.S. and now suddenly he's in Nogales. And you start to see how I think so many of these men, like Mr. Hernandez, there are men that in some way like went to war, and nobody understands the depth of their pain, because they went from living in, you know, Fresno, California, working on a dairy farm, taking the kids to school, to being on the border in the middle of a narco war, like humiliated by border patrol, you know, kidnapped by the narcos, and they are just trying to make it back, you know. And Hernandez tried maybe like 4 or 5 times, was practically kidnapped, humiliated. It just went through like everything a man can go through. And it comes to a point where they just don't want to call home because they don't know what to tell the kids, you know? And you don't, how can you explain to a 4-year-old that you're deported? They don't get it, right? And so, you know, Mr. Hernandez, determined as he was, on his like 6th attempt, walked to Phoenix. And he called me when he was arriving to Phoenix and he said, Natalia, tengo bien jodido el pie. My foot is all messed up, but I'm in Phoenix and, you know, thank you. And then he left. And I think what I have learned from him and from people in general is that the human spirit is very resilient. So you just really don't see an out to the situation. There seems to be no out to the situation. Yeah, I remember them and I get really like upset, man, because there's so many stories of parents where they're like, they did everything right. They did everything right they were supposed to do. And then one day they woke up and they're like, you're not seeing your kids ever again. And they're like, what? Why would we do this to people? It's just, it's so sick. I hope some famous person makes a really good movie that makes us open up our eyes of what we did to these Mexican families. Not only Mexican, although I think they took the weight of it, of the post 9/11 world. But man, it was, yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. And in these situations, do you feel like art is especially important in inspiring hope and sort of rallying people to channel that resilience?
Art gives communities an opportunity of remembering where they come from. You know, if you have no sense of your story and the value of your story, you're just lacking in force to make it better, you know? And so I think art has that power to be like, this is where we come from, and we're proud of where we come from, you know? And and we're here and we're not going away, and not only in the Latino community, but in the Black community, it's like you can be really a close-minded racist person, but you see somebody sing, you know, regardless of where they come from, and you're like, wow, that person has a soul, that person has spirit, that person is, you know, I think the art has that way of like really tearing down certain boundaries that we build up.
With the crisis on the border, and it feels like it's never ending, and even with the photos that have recently come out of the Haitian immigrants on the border, your work is becoming increasingly more and more important. And how do you feel specifically that you're contributing to sort of ease the struggle or resolve sort of some of the tension of the immigration policy?
I think just when you... Most of these songs, they're all born in the same place, you know. They're born of a friendship with a very particular person, and out of like a deep sense of like solidarity with what they're going through or with their pain. And these songs are just like reflecting, you know, that pain that the person is feeling. And I think that for the audience, what I would hope for is that when they sit with these songs, it just brings them back to reality, you know, because in the world of media and Facebook and the internet, it's like there's just so much noise, you know, and everybody has like an opinion about the world, you know, and then you just sit with a person, you're like, so where are you from and what's going on with your life? And wow, man, that's really hard, you know. I think it just reminds us, like, we're just people on this earth, you know. I want to believe, at least, that the songs just bring us back to the fact that we're just people, you know. We're people here, and like the only way to really be on this earth and to be fully human is to like remember that we're just like one family sitting here, you know. I think once you start to get away from this. From that reality, the fact that we're really just one family and we're not that different one from another. Our circumstances are different, but our pains are not, you know. We get a possibility of just like really, really being on earth and really being for each other. And when we don't assume that reality, when we don't face that truth that we're just one family here, we start to really get caught up in a vicious cycle of nastiness. And of policies like the ones you see on the border, where not only the U.S., but countries are increasingly closing their borders and making it more and more difficult. And it's just really not, like, what's the world that we want to live in? It's not the world. It's not, in my opinion, it's not the way forward, you know.
Sweet. Thank you for your thoughtful answers. Those are all the questions that we have from Alt Latino. Is there anything else that I'm not asking that you want to mention or talk about?
I think one of the better decisions I made when I was in college or a couple years ago or younger, I don't know, was to like be curious about the world around me and what was going on around me, you know, and going out to the marches and seeing the Latino community on the street and getting curious about migrants on the border. Like, I would say to all of those folks, especially not to say that older people can't get involved, but especially young people, man, you have a chance to just do whatever the heck you want with your life, man. Anything. Especially if you're in college or post-college, just like throw the world out the window. You, like, go to the border. I don't know, if you feel called to Africa, go to Africa. If you feel called, just like get involved with the world. Like, I think we're really afraid, especially in this world, that we're just not gonna make it, that we're not gonna have enough, that we're gonna like starve to death and not pay rent. It's like the world will take care of you, you know? Go out. If you're not involved in your neighborhood, go out and get involved with your neighborhood, get involved with your neighbors, get involved in the marches, like just get a taste for the world, because it's changing and it's gonna keep changing, and the world in 50 years will not be the world today, and it's gotta have to be a different world, because otherwise we're not gonna be here. So that's what I would say. And beside that, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it's my pleasure. A veces, entre las noches paso frío, mi
pie izquierdo anda empujado. A veces no quiero andar más.
Thanks again to Rihanna Cruz from Team Alt Latino, and also to the NAHJ, Beatriz Limon, who wrote a story about La Muna, and Noel Haro Gomez, who took the photos. You can find all of that at palabranahj.org. And finally, we're going to hear about a music festival that takes place in northern Baja California. And if you're thinking cowboy hats and accordions, think again. Baja Beach Fest has become one of the biggest celebrations of reggaeton anywhere. It's 2 days featuring the biggest names in the genre, and it's spread out over 2 weekends in Rosarito Beach, which is just 30 miles south of San Diego. I spoke with the festival's promoters, Chris Den Owl and Aaron Ampudia, who explained why they chose Baja to stage a reggaeton event.
We really started to see a rise of the genre's popularity kind of hitting the masses. Really in 2017, we saw it. We really cater to the Mexican-American audience. I would say that like 90% or more of our fan base is Mexican-American.
And the culture has been there in that town, you know, like ever since when my dad started it 39 years ago, you know, it's been Mexican-Americans or Americans from California coming down. And it's such a unique spot that's 30 minutes away from San Diego. It just made perfect sense.
It also seems like it's a reflection of just how popular reggaeton is beyond its initial fan base or demographic base of the Afro-Caribbean populations in the Northeast, because that's reflected in the number of views and streaming that these artists have worldwide. They globally dominate the viewing and the streaming thing, you know, regularly. It struck me that this is like a living, breathing example of how popular this music is outside of that community, and in particular within the Mexican American community. I mean, have you ever thought about it that way? That it's like really, it's like a very living and breathing example of how popular the music is?
From day one, we felt that way. And I think that with the artists and the people have been able to prove that this is one of the biggest genres in the world. And, you know, I think us being able to go from one weekend and 2 days to 2 weekends with 3 days was a really great example of how large this community really is.
Talk to me a little bit about that lifestyle, that community that is the border. I guess, Aaron, since, you know, you guys have been down there for so long and you're probably raised down there, how is it different than other parts of Mexico and even in other parts of the United States?
I feel like it's the Americanized part of Mexico. You know, being so close to San Diego, at least us. You know, I grew up in Ensenada, which is not a border town, or Rosarito, but Tijuana's right there. And our regular thing would be to go to San Diego on the weekends, you know? If we were able to. But then looking to people, for example, from Mexico City, well, they maybe come once a year, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a whole different culture. When the first times that I was old enough going by myself to Mexico City, paying in dollars anywhere in Baja, it's normal. But paying in dollars in Mexico City, no way, you know? You got to make sure you exchange your money, do all of that. So there's like this crossover in Baja where people feel safe and they feel like they're kind of at home, but away from home. You know, you're in Mexico in another country, but it's pretty similar in a way to some of the things that you see in Southern California, at least for Baja Norte.
There's also that aspect too of, for example, my mother's family is from New Mexico. And, you know, the family history is that they never left. The border moved on them, right? That's how far back they go. So that whole stretch, that it's a unique part of both the United States and Mexico, because there's a sense that you're living in both worlds. There's a border culture where you live in both worlds,
Siseca, the idea of a bicultural, a bilingual presence, just nature, just slip from one language to the other easily like that.
Yeah, and you get a lot of people that live, there's a huge community that of Americans, you know, that were like, we want to retire in Baja, you know? There's a bunch of crossover both ways that I think benefits everyone. And then, I mean, I always push on this like nonsense of, you know, I get asked a lot because of the businesses that we have in Baja with Americans or Mexican Americans of, oh, is it safe to cross? Is it safe to do this? You know, and then people drive across or walk across and they're like, that's it. You know, they don't believe it's that easy to go back and forth. You know, we cross over around 70,000-80,000 people in 2 weekends, you know, and there's no issues really.
Talk a little bit about the economic impact you guys are having there. Whenever you bring so many people in, are they staying at hotels? Are they eating at the restaurants? You know, what type of economic impact are you guys having on the area?
Well, that's the huge part. Every Airbnb and VRBO from Tijuana to Rosarito, every hotel in Rosarito gets sold out within 4 hours that we announce the dates. And then all the way down to basically Ensenada. So you can't find a hotel. You got to ride a shuttle or maybe stay in San Diego. So the economic impact is huge. And that's part of the reason why we had so much support from the state. Some businesses, we went and asked them, you know, like, what does this mean to you? It's like, it saved our year, you know, it might have saved my business because of COVID. And it was the first festival back in a year and a half, you know, or the first concert. We were the first festival in Mexico to happen. It was huge for sure.
And one more thing, what do the artists, what do they tell you about being able to go to this area and perform? What is their reaction?
The whole premise of like the beach and creating this really cool inclusive event, not just for like the people, but for the artists, has gotten tons of really great feedback. Like, it's the only festival right now where, you know, 30 to 50 artists come together with all their teams and celebrate together in a really unique place that kind of symbolizes a lot of that like beach and island vibe and feel. And so it just touches them, I think, a bit differently than like the traditional park festival or hard ticket concert. So it's very much family vibes from every touch point. It's pretty special. They really enjoy it.
Thanks for spending time with us along the border. We want to remind you to check out the photos about the bullfighting school at npr.org/thepictureshow and go to palabranahj.org for photos of La Muna and her work with refugees in Mexico. Also, we have 2 more weeks of our special takeover of the Tiny Desk concerts for Hispanic Heritage Month coming up on El Tiny are videos for Sech and Yendri this week. You have been listening to Alt Latino from NPR Music. I'm Felix Contreras. As usual, thank you so much for listening. Man, stay safe. Stay safe out there, fam.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
On this week's Wild Card, we talk with Issa Rae about those moments where our lives could have gone another direction.
Definitely wasn't supposed to be with that guy at all. But I still think about it.
I'm Rachel Martin. Issa Rae tells us how to make peace with the path not taken. That's on the Wild Card podcast from NPR, the game where cards control the conversation.